From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. On today's Fresh Air, the Odyssey of a Vietnamese Family, we talk with journalist and NPR commentator Duc Nguyen about his new memoir, Where the Ashes Are. Nguyen's family was ripped apart by the war. His father was sent to a Viet Cong prison camp. His mother lost her job as a school principal and was forced to hawk goods on the streets. Eventually, Nguyen came to the U.S. by way of a cargo ship. In 1984, he was reunited with his parents. Also, a humorous novel about a writer, his memoir, and his family secrets. We talk with novelist Ben Cheever. He's the son of writer the late John Cheever. His new novel is called The Partisan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton says he didn't know of two White House meetings in which his advisors discussed the Whitewater investigation with Treasury Department officials involved in the probe. And he says the Whitewater investigation is no Watergate, despite Republican efforts to portray it as such. A special counsel is looking into Mr. and Mrs. Clinton's relations with the owner of an Arkansas savings and loan that collapsed. The counsel is also investigating the Clintons' ties to the Whitewater real estate deal, which may have been improperly financed with the SNL funds. Mr. Clinton used part of a news conference today to defend his wife's integrity.
I have never known a person with a stronger sense of right and wrong in my life, ever. I could cite you chapter and verse over 20 years plus now that I have known her, when it would have been very easy for her to take a shortcut, to take an easy way out, to do something else, when she has unfailingly done the right thing. And I do not believe for a moment that she has done anything wrong.
Meanwhile, Republicans are demanding congressional hearings into Whitewater. Minority Whip Newt Gingrich today called for a leadership meeting to schedule a series of hearings on the matter. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Gingrich says congressional hearings will not interfere with the ongoing investigation conducted by Special Counsel Robert Fisk.
To the degree that there are criminal acts that are involved, that's Mr. Fisk's problem. And Mr. Fisk should deal with it as the independent counsel. To the degree that we can learn factually what has happened, that is our assignment in order to educate the legislative branch and in order to educate the country.
But Gingrich says Congress should not be able to grant any witnesses immunity for their testimony, which occurred during the Iran-Contra scandal and undermined the eventual case. Gingrich says Republican demands for hearings should not be seen as partisan. He says they're driven by the media, the same media which he said months ago got the president elected in the first place. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Two military industrial firms say they want to merge. Martin Marietta and Grumman Corporation say their deal is worth nearly $2 billion. Martin Marietta will pay $55 per share for Grumman's outstanding stock. Grumman's chairman says his firm decided it could not thrive in the current business climate without taking action. The Supreme Court has unanimously ruled that the parody version of the song Pretty Woman by the rap group Two Live Crew is not an illegal copyright violation. The justices say copyright owners may not ban parodies of their songs. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 27 points at 3,859. The NASDAQ is up 4.5 points at 795. This is NPR. The PLO chairman is in Cairo to discuss peace talks with Israel, but he's under growing pressure to give up the negotiations. More than 100 PLO members have sent Yasser Arafat a memo urging him to walk out of the talks. The members say quitting the talks and retracting all agreements made with Israel is the least action they should take after an attack on a West Bank mosque. The peace negotiations between Israel and the PLO are stalled. Motorola has introduced a new device which the company says will push palm-top computing and wireless communications to a higher level. NPR's John McChesney reports.
Motorola's new device is called the Envoy. It's a personal digital assistant that can carry on two-way wireless data communications. Apple led the way in this market with its much-maligned Newton, but last week Apple announced an improved Newton with upgraded handwriting recognition software. Motorola did not include handwriting recognition capability in the new Envoy. Motorola says the state-of-the-art simply isn't good enough yet. The Envoy will use ARDIS, the nation's largest wireless network, jointly owned by Motorola and IBM. ARDIS links with a service that will allow an Envoy user to send wireless email to anyone with an Internet address. Users can also tap into online information services or exchange files with other personal computers, all wireless. Entering text in the Envoy will be slow, though, since the unit has no external keyboard. The Envoy is clearly aimed at the upscale early adopter of technology. It will sell for $1,500. In San Francisco, I'm John McChesney reporting.
Money Magazine has listed the best towns and cities for retirees. Prescott, Arizona led the way. The magazine says the town offers fresh mountain air, plenty of cultural activity, and affordable housing. Prescott is followed by other cities like Fairhope, Alabama, Mount Dora, Florida, Las Vegas, and Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In 1975, Duc Nguyen was one of the many Vietnamese who fled their country to come to the United States. He was 15 years old and came alone, leaving his mother, father, and sister behind. His father was a prisoner of the North Vietnamese. After the North won the war, his mother lost her job as a school principal and ended up selling noodles on the streets of Ho Chi Minh City. His sister, who had mental problems, died in Vietnam. Duc Nguyen got out and joined his brother in Ohio. After a difficult transition to life in America, Nguyen has become a writer and radio producer. His new memoir, Where the Ashes Are, has just been published. He now works at KALW, a public radio station in San Francisco. And a few years ago, he produced an award-winning radio series about his first trip back to Vietnam in 1989. Nguyen's father had been a high-ranking civil servant in the South Vietnamese government. I asked him what their life was like before the war.
We were rather privileged because of the position that my father had. We were rather lucky. And being in the urban areas, the war didn't affect us until the Tet Offensive.
How political was your family? Were they staunchly anti-communist?
My father has always been anti-communist and had worked for the South Vietnamese government and believed in the ideals of democracies that had been promulgated in the South.
Now, your family was in Hue in 1968 during the Tet Offensive. Describe what it was like.
We went to Hue for the Tet Festival and to visit my grandparents who were living there, and my family is from Hue. And as we were arriving into town, we knew that there was a ceasefire, and yet there were a lot of activities, and there were a lot of military trucks and troops movement. And then two nights after we arrived there, firecrackers were going off everywhere, and we didn't know that the firecrackers weren't really firecrackers, and they were actually gunfight, and there were battles going on around the outskirts of town. And then about 2 a.m, we started noticing that there were soldiers outside, and they weren't South Vietnamese soldiers anymore. They were actually the enemy, the Viet Cong, who had entered into the city of Hue and had surrounded the compound or the building that my family was staying in, and that was the government guest house.
Did the Viet Cong know who your family was?
At first they didn't. They thought it was the general that had stayed there before the week before my father arrived, and they thought my father was that general. And it took them a while to find out that actually my father wasn't in the military and that he was a government official.
Tell us how then your family was captured, and this is in Hue.
In Hue, that night the Viet Cong came in and took everybody and then separated the women and the children from the men and took most of the men up to the top floor of the government guest house. My mother and I were taken down with other families or other women and children into a basement, a long basement, and we were kept there while my father was kept with all the prisoners being prepared to be taken away. And so we were separated from my father, and I had a couple of chances to go up and say goodbye to him, basically, and brought him some water and some rice and a few articles of clothing. But after that, we never saw him again until the very night when he was being marched away, the next night when they marched him away at 2 a.m.
And this is when he was being marched away for re-education.
Right. And we hadn't realized that he was going to be away for 12 years. We just knew that he was being taken away. And we were all confused and shocked. And we had no idea that the whole entire town was taken over by, had been taken over by the communist soldiers. And we stayed there for about 10 days until American soldiers came and the Viet Cong had withdrawn from the area. They stayed on in the city of Hue for about a month in various parts. But the American soldiers came and brought us away to a safer area, which happened to be a university.
I want to have you read a section from your book, and you were taken away, actually hidden in a medical clinic, your mother and your sister and yourself, and had a chance to watch the fighting. And I'd love to have you read a section about what you saw.
Right. This is a temporary medical clinic that had been set up in the university, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people per room, per classroom, and we were all on straw mats, so I'll read that part. Death happened swiftly and frequently in those days. The green field behind the university had been turned into a graveyard. Every day the same men would dig grave after shallow grave. Men, women, children, their bodies wound in pieces of fabric, sheets or straw mats, were laid to rest with no ceremony. I roamed the balcony ringing the sixth floor for hours. "What do you do out there all day?" Yu Ha would ask in the evenings. "Just wander," I said. One morning, an old man in a faded army shirt and a pair of black shorts was drawing water from a well at the edge of the field. I had watched him for most of the morning. He pulled cans of water from the well to fill up two buckets. Using a pole hoisted across his shoulders, he then carried the buckets back to the high-rise. It was exhausting work. From the balcony, I could see that his hair was mostly white, his legs thin and dark. Whether the men let out a cry or not as he slipped, I did not hear, but I could see the blood turning his hair red. His head had struck the cement wall encircling the well. Half an hour later, he was being readied for burial. A man, perhaps a son, wrapped a mat around the body. Two others comforted a woman trashing by the side of the hole dug in the ground. Each of them had tied a piece of white cloth like a loose turban around his head in lieu of the elaborate white clothing Vietnamese traditionally wear at funerals. Once the dead man was buried, the woman knelt on the ground, but her sons guided her away after just a few perfunctory bows. I was still watching from the balcony when one of the men rushed out and, with desperate movements, unearthed the body. The two grave diggers leaned on their shovels nearby. Clawing at the corpse, holding it to his chest, the man rocked it back and forth. Although I could not hear, I could see his mouth open in an anguished cry. I wanted to get Yu Ha to come see the scene, but by the time I was ready to move away, the old man was being buried for the second time.
And that's my guest, Nguyen Quy Duc, and his book is called Where the Ashes Are. Looking out at the scene below where you were, did you think you were going to die?
I saw a lot of that happening, a lot of people dying. I was too young to realize that I could die, I could be hit by bullets right away or easily. I was just so mesmerized by all the things that were happening around there. And as a young boy, I mean, it was fascinating to see all of this happening. I saw a woman giving birth to a child on the steps of this university. I saw people dying. I saw people lying in the hallways with a candle at their head, knowing that was dead, that was death.
But it didn't scare you.
It was shocking. I think I went through the whole 10 days there in a state of almost a shock and fascination at the same time.
You were and your family were evacuated back to Da Nang. How much safer was it than in Da Nang than in Hue?
Da Nang was safer because of the military bases on the outskirts of town. So they kept the town fairly quiet. No Viet Cong soldiers could come into town, and we continued our life, despite the absence of my father. We began to have a normal life. I went back to school, But at night, we would hear gunfire. I don't know where they came from, a shot or two here and there, and that would just make us jump out of bed.
Could you really live a normal life not knowing where your father was or how he was?
Normal, as much as conditions allowed in those days, whereas we would get up in the morning, have a bit of breakfast and go to school, but you would come home and there would be a strange atmosphere at home because my father wasn't there, and we tried not to acknowledge that absence, and yet we know that it was there. And then my grandfather came in to live with us from Hue, and we had to keep the news about my father's capture away from him. We feared that if he learned about the news, he would not be able to withstand it and would have a heart attack. And so he was wondering where my father was, and we kept lying to him for a long time. And that was really horrible. My mother would have to stop at her neighbor's house to cry because she couldn't cry at home, and she had to hide from my grandfather.
And your grandfather did finally find out what happened to your father. What happened to him?
He then just became ill for a while, and a couple of years later died of cancer. And he just became very weak after he heard the news, and we kept waiting for news from my father, and we didn't hear anything until years later. And then he died, and my father, being the first son or the only son, was away, and my older brother was in Ohio studying as a student in the United States. So the responsibility passed down on to me as the male of the family in that culture. And so I had to bear certain responsibilities.
I'm speaking with Duc Nguyen about his memoir, Where the Ashes Are. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Duc Nguyen. We're talking about his family's experiences during the Vietnam War. Now, while your family was in Da Nang, your father was being held by the North Vietnamese. As you learned about what happened to him when you finally hooked up with him in 1980, what had his capture been like?
He had been marched up the Ho Chi Minh Trail during the time of the bombings, the American bombings of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And it took almost a year and a half for him to get to the north. And then he was mostly in solitary confinement. The Viet Cong had by then found out that he was the highest government official from the south that they had captured. And they wanted to keep him partly as a bargaining tool, but partly as a way to find out information about the south. And they kept him in isolation. They didn't torture him physically, though his physical conditions were horrendous. I mean, he lived in underground chambers and basically holes dug in underground or in isolation cells. But the mental games that he had to play with his captors to write the confessions that they asked of him daily and to answer all the questions without giving away secrets of the south, that was the most difficult part for him. So the psychological torture was tremendous.
They accused him of having CIA ties. That was a pretty standard accusation back then?
Particularly because he had a period of studies in the United States, and so anybody who spoke English who'd gone to America at all in the 60s or before was accused of that, was accused of being a CIA agent. So he had to answer a lot of those questions as well, and of his ties to the Americans in the South.
He wrote poetry to keep from going insane. Had he ever written poetry before?
He had written very few poems before that, but he'd always been very disciplined and a man concerned with literature, and he had been a teacher in his early years of adulthood. But he knew that in order to stay sane, he would have to have some sort of mental exercise. So he either would write poems in his head, and he couldn't write them down, obviously. But the poems reinforced also his loyalty to the southern government. And he also tried to recreate books in his head that he'd read in, as a child and as a young man. He tried to recreate those books chapter by chapter just to keep his mind functioning.
In 1973, when the North and South signed the peace treaty in Paris, why wasn't your father released like so many others?
It is still a mystery to us all up to this point. We guess that it was because they had wanted to keep him as a bargaining tool at the negotiation tables in Paris. And then after everybody was released, they kept him and some others. We still don't know why. And then later on, we believe that he was basically forgotten. He was never given a sentence. He was never tried for anything. And it was considered re-education. And re-education can last as long as your guards didn't think that you'd change your attitudes.
After the peace accord was signed, did your life change in any way when the South lost the war?
Well, after the peace accord was signed, that was the first time we'd heard from my father. There were prisoners from the North who'd come back in a prisoner exchange program, and they brought back a little piece of paper from my father, and he was saying that he wanted my mother to do everything possible to keep us in school and that he couldn't tell when he was coming back. And that was the first time we'd heard from my father. We'd always kept hope that he was alive. We never believed that he'd been killed. So in that way, we lived with the hope that we would be able to see our fathers again. And then in 1974 or 75, early 75, the war had intensified. And the communists came into central Vietnam where we were. And on the last days of Da Nang, my mother sent me to Saigon thinking that she would join us the next day. And she got stuck behind in March of 1975. So I ended up in Saigon for the month of April, staying with relatives in Vietnam. And by this time, the whole idea of an escape from Vietnam because the communists was going to win the war became an idea that everybody entertained.
So how were you able to get out of the country?
I had relatives who had ties to the Americans in Saigon. I had an uncle who was doing research for the American companies there. And because of that, we were allowed onto an American plane that took us away from Saigon. And I had left a sister there, and my mother was stuck in central Vietnam. And then I got onto a cargo ship from a southern island in Vietnam, and then we sailed away from Vietnam the last day of South Vietnam, the day the communist tanks rolled into Saigon. I was on the cargo ship sailing away from Vietnam and on my way to Guam and then on to the United States.
You arrived in Ohio in the spring of 1975, and you write, "Like a scorned lover, I could not believe any future happiness was possible." Did you feel utterly alone?
I felt utterly isolated. Ohio, as you know, in the suburbs of Ohio, people live behind closed doors. You get out and you get into the car. You don't talk to your neighbor. I didn't have the English to talk to neighbors. I didn't know anyone at all. And I had difficulties as well relating to my brother, who had been by then in the United States for 10 years. He was having trouble trying to feed me and my sister and his family. And so I had incredible difficulties, and I had no one to talk to, and I had no friends. And in Vietnam, I was used to the kind of life where you walk down the streets and you see friends and you talk to your neighbors, and there was a community around you. I was never alone in Vietnam, and here I was in Ohio, wandering around the place where nobody walked on the street.
Did you try to fit in? You were 15 years old. That's often when kids feel the desperate need to belong.
I knew that I was different. I went to school and was harassed by other kids, and because they knew I was different, obviously, and they would do things to my bike, take a bolt off, take the wheel off, the tire off, and things like that. And so I couldn't fit in at all. So I ended up, after 3 months, wanting to leave that. And I wrote to a friend who was in Canada, in Montreal, and he said, "Well, why don't you come and live with us, and you can get a job making rings at this ring factory and work and live with us." And so I did, but I never made it across the border. I didn't have the proper paper.
You write that you weren't used to the American habit of complaining about parents, and as we all know, that's what American teenagers do. Was it that was just such a different culture?
I think I was in shock when I first went to Virginia. I left Ohio and I ended up in Virginia, and I went to school there in Ohio. And my friends would come to school and would say things like, oh, I hate my father. I can't stand the guy. And things like that would shock me because I didn't have my father. I wanted my father back. I wanted my mother back. And in Vietnamese culture, one can never say that. I mean, you may have disagreement and you may feel wronged by your parents, but you can never, ever feel hatred towards your parents. And here were American youngsters who were saying things like that to me. And the other things that were shocking was that they came from very good families. I mean, I lived in a rather exclusive area of Virginia, where my uncle was living, and the parents were generals at the Pentagon and people working in the government in Washington, D.C. And the kids were saying things like that about their parents and were fighting with their parents. And I'd seen kids fighting with their parents, and it was horrendous.
Your father was released from prison in 1980. And he and your mother came to the States. What year was that? What year did they come to the United States?
He was released in 1980, and we had started sponsorship process for them to come to the United States for to be reunified with the family. And so they came in 1984. It took about 4 years to get the paperwork done. And so they came to California, and I lived with them in 1984. Of course, that was a tremendous time of rediscovery and of finding each other again, of having parents again, and also of coming to terms with the years of separation, the years of my father in prison, and of how different I've turned out from their expectations.
Mm. What did they expect for you?
They expected that I would have taken the opportunities in this country and By then, I was 25 years old. I should have gotten my PhD and was living a rather secure life in the United States. And they were shocked that I had none of this, that they came into the house and I had not accumulated a whole lot of material things. And neither had I established myself as a professional in any ways.
When your father got released from prison, what condition was he in?
I had expected him to be in terrible physical and psychological difficulties, and yet he was very sane, he was very strong, and he's still very healthy now, thank heaven. And he was utterly, utterly sane and calm and composed and disciplined as he ever was.
Well, you write that they took to the United States more than you did. Why?
Because of their suffering, I think, in Vietnam, because of the opportunities that they had here, that they could think and talk about things freely, that the things that they couldn't do in Vietnam at all, that they could live without fear, and that they were at 60 years of age and 65 years of age, they're a lot more accepting of America.
You recently went back to Vietnam, actually, for NPR. What were you looking for?
I was looking for childhood, for the opportunity to see my homeland again and to see whether I could fit back in, because I miss a lot of the things that I had known in my youth. And over the years in America, I wanted to recapture that. And also, I had to go back and bring the ashes that had been left behind, the ashes of my sister. And so I went back and looked for ashes, and the idea was to have the ashes in the United States for us to worship, as Vietnamese tradition would dictate. And so I brought the ashes back to the United States, and the idea was that where the ashes are, one would make that a home, that my family is now complete in the United States.
Duc Nguyen's memoir is called Where the Ashes Are. He works at public radio station KALW in San Francisco. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Benjamin Cheever has followed in the footsteps of his famous father, writer John Cheever. But Ben's style is distinctly his own. He was hailed as a major new comic writer after his debut novel, The Plagiarist, was published. His latest funny novel is called The Partisan. Coming up, we talk with Benjamin Cheever. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Antenna, the new release by the Texas band ZZ Top. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says the United States is inclined to support a UN peacekeeping force in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, but that will depend on whether the warring parties can work out a peace agreement. No U.S. troops would be peacekeepers. President Clinton is meeting with Georgian leader Eduard Shevardnadze at the White House. The administration has promised Georgia $70 million in humanitarian and technical aid. Shevardnadze says his country is on the brink of famine. Bosnian Croat and government forces are obeying the guidelines of a ceasefire. They've met today's deadline to start turning over their heavy weapons to United Nations forces. The BBC's Jim Muir reports from Sarajevo.
Both sides began moving their heavy guns and tanks well in advance of the deadline. Some were removed from the area altogether. Mortars are meant to be pulled back 10 kilometers from the ceasefire lines and artillery pieces 20. Others are being gathered up under the supervision of United Nations forces, UNPROFOR, at 5 collection points dotted around the area. This deadline was different from that which heralded similar moves recently around Sarajevo, which was imposed by the outside powers and backed up by the threat of NATO airstrikes if the guns weren't removed. The central Bosnian arrangements were freely agreed by the mainly Muslim government and the Bosnian Croats, with the UN forces invited to monitor their voluntary compliance. So there's no question of NATO airstrikes, for example, if infractions come to light. It will be up to the two sides themselves to sort it out, with whatever help they need from UNPROFOR.
Jim Muir reporting. Warning strikes by German public workers in several northern German cities this morning halted public transportation. NPR's Dieter Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Some residents of Braunschweig, Lüneburg, and Göttingen had a hard time getting to work this morning. Angry workers refuse to operate public transportation. The walkouts are part of a nationwide wave of warning strikes by public employees the past 2 weeks to underline their readiness to strike if they do not get pay hikes. The union wants a 4% salary raise to keep up with inflation. A wage dispute last year in the public sector led to week-long strikes that crippled public services. Another round of wage talks is scheduled for Wednesday. There are hopes a breakthrough settlement over the weekend in the metal industry may pave the way for a similar accord with public workers. The metal union agreed to a 1.5% pay raise in exchange for limited job guarantees. I'm Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
Republican Congressman Jim Leach is playing down talk about impeaching President Clinton over the Whitewater investigation. Leach has been spearheading the GOP effort to get the White House to release more information on the matter, but he says it is inappropriate to suggest the presidency is in jeopardy. Stock prices moved up today on Wall Street. The Dow rose nearly 24 points to end at 3,856. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The American Civil Liberties Union is protesting the use of pepper spray as an effective weapon that doesn't kill. This contradicts a report by the International Association of Chiefs of Police. That report examined 22 cases where suspects in custody died after police used pepper spray to subdue them. The study says the pepper and oil mixture was not a factor in any of the examined deaths, but the ACLU says that's not true. The group has released autopsy reports of 14 California victims. It says results show even if pepper spray wasn't the cause of death, it was a factor. A UN organization says global unemployment has risen to its worst level since the Great Depression. The group says nearly one of three workers is either out of work or earning too little to live decently. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
In the United States, growing numbers of the unemployed are finding jobs, but around the world, millions are out of work. The International Labor Organization says 120 million people are registered as unemployed, and still millions more never bother to register. The ILO says both industrial and developing countries face persistent long-term joblessness. The group's director says practically half of the 35 million unemployed workers in Western Europe have been off the payrolls for a year or more. The ILO report also estimates that some 700 million people around the world are underemployed, earning less than needed to support a minimum standard of living. The ILO says Japan remained at the bottom of the unemployment list. There will be a two-day meeting later this month in Detroit on the world joblessness problem. President Clinton has invited officials of the six other major industrial countries to participate. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Entertainer Frank Sinatra is resting comfortably at home in California after he collapsed from exhaustion. He was in concert last night in Virginia when he fell on stage. He'd complained earlier of how hot the auditorium was. He was treated and released from a Richmond hospital after a series of tests last night. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Having a famous writer as a father is a hard act to follow, especially if you want to be a writer yourself. Ben Cheever is the son of John Cheever, the Pulitzer Prize-winning short story writer and novelist. Ben Cheever worked as an editor at Reader's Digest for 10 years before he edited a collection of his father's letters and turned to writing full-time. He then wrote his first novel, published in 1992, called, of all things, The Plagiarist. His newest novel, called The Partisan, is a humorous and touching portrait of the family of Jonas Collingwood, a critically acclaimed and publicly ignored writer of gloomy novels. Collingwood has been offered a hefty advance to write a memoir of his experiences in World War II. The book is to be called The Partisan. In Ben Cheever's hands, the novel explores the powerful dynamic between Collingwood and his adopted son Nelson, the corrosive nature of family secrets, and the futile quest for happiness. It's narrated by Nelson Collingwood. Ben Cheever works at home these days, writing and taking care of his children. He's married to New York Times film critic Janet Maslin. Let's begin with a reading from the opening of The Partisan.
That was the summer I worked for the Westchester Commons. I was in love with Amy Snodgrass Rose. Amy was in love with David Hitchens. David was in love with Gloria Thomas. I was in Westchester. Amy was in Washington State. David was in Montreal. Gloria had gone to Paris. The sex was very safe, and I was very lonely.
What I like so much about that is a kind of rhythm that you set up, and also, of course, the humor that moves through that paragraph, but also throughout the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to work at that?
When I was a kid, people thought I was funny, and I would try and write funny things, and sometimes I'd write one funny thing, and then I'd try again, and I'd write something that wasn't funny, and there's nothing more awful than something that's supposed to be funny and is not. Then, when I started really spending a lot of time writing, I discovered that what you wrote was something sad, and it turns out to be funny. If you wrote something that happened that was sad, and you made it a little sadder than it was, and you tell it to people, they think it's hilarious.
And why is that? Because it's happening to someone else and not them? The difference between comedy and tragedy, of course.
That's right, is it's happening to someone else. I think that's part of it, but I think also sadness creates humor. I mean, you laugh at sad things. When my father died, the day the family all got together to go to the funeral, we were all in hysterics. And at the funeral, in fact, people were quite critical. But that's just how we react to things that we find unpleasant.
How would you describe Nelson? And he's the person that tells the story.
Well, I like him a lot, but he's more an observer. He's less active than maybe he ought to be. He's not sure what he wants. He wants desperately to be liked. And one of the critics who didn't like the book said that this was adolescent, and that Nelson cares terribly about having people love him, and this is an adolescent phase. And I'm 45, and I still desperately care about having people like me. I don't know what I'm supposed to go on to. I mean, what is, if you don't terribly want the approval of other people, then what is it you do want? Do you want money? Is that more important than the approval of other people? Do you want fame? Do you want cleaner highways? I don't know what it is that's more important than having other people like you.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from this book, and this is the beginning. It's actually on page 55.
All right.
This is chapter 6.
Okay. I'm glad you asked me to read this, because in some ways I think it's the heart of the book. I've always been mystified by the interest adult adopted children take in their biological parents. They appear on TV, they write books, they are careful to explain that they have wonderful adoptive parents, but still they want to track down the real ones. What in God's name are these people looking for? Don't they know that by the time they're 21, they've had the only childhood they're entitled to? There's something ridiculous about the search, those big, sad faces yearning for a missing babyhood. They should get drunk instead, or hit somebody, or cry. Bloodlines have always seemed to me to be entirely beside the point. Love is a choice. Families are made, not found. Those pivotal connections are forged by some mysterious alchemy of tenderness and cruelty, not by the matching of genetic fingerprints. What is this mania for real parents? Your real parents are the ones you have. Romulus and Remus were suckled by a wolf. They founded Rome. Winston Churchill was brought up by a nanny. He hardly even saw his biologicals. Once you're raised, you're raised. Don't some Gestalt therapists claim that it's never too late for a happy childhood? Nonsense. It's conceivable that the victim of a disastrous upbringing can become happy, or at least a successful adult, but he'll never become a happy child, not unless you drop him on his head. Still, I suppose I should take the time to explain how it was that Sister and I came to be raised by strangers. I'm not as interested in this as are the viewers of 60 Minutes, but here it is. We were both adopted by Elspeth's sister Lily and by her husband Hamilton Ballard. The Ballards lived across the Hudson in Montvale, New Jersey. They were childless. Hamilton, a lawyer, was deeply involved in school politics. When a bright young girl whom he'd been counseling got pregnant, he was the first one she told. She was then a senior at the local high school with a full scholarship to a distinguished college. The father was said to have been an auto mechanic. The unborn child threatened to ruin her life. The Ballards sent Ms. X to a lodge in New Hampshire, and in the fullness of time, they adopted the baby boy. That was 1971. I was that baby.
And that's my guest, Ben Cheever, reading from his latest novel called The Partisan. As a parent, do you feel the tug of biology? Are you immune to that? When you look at your sons, you say, I made that?
No, I don't say I made that. It seems very mysterious to me that this other creature is so complete. Should have any biological connection to me. And when I first saw a baby, the first time I ever saw a baby that was mine, my reaction was horror.
Horror?
Well, yes. We had a black Labrador, and when she had puppies, I remember she was shocked. She thought, I guess, that she was constipated, and suddenly there was this little yowling thing, one of many, it turned out. And her first reaction was fright and horror, and that was my first reaction to being a father. This entity, and children seem to bring their own destiny with them, really, into the world, with its own needs.
Well, and what interests me in that section is that it seems to run counter to a certain trend to reclaim a childhood, to go back and take one's teddy bear, spiritual teddy bear, one's actual teddy bear, and try to recapture, relive a certain elusive happiness. And does that bother you, this trend to reconstruct childhood and do it right somehow?
Well, it does bother me. I think what bothers me most is the idea that we can be made happier by blaming our parents. And obviously part of the reason I take this position now is I'm becoming more a parent and less a child. But I think that's an unhelpful way of looking at life. I don't think blame works. I don't think it's a good thing to get too heavily involved in.
Where do you think that comes from? Because it seems very culturally driven.
Well, I don't know. I think there's an unwillingness, and this may be because of advertising, to accept how difficult life is. I think life is difficult. I think it's difficult for parents and for children. It's difficult for rich people and poor people. I think it's really tough, and we're not supposed to accept that. It's supposed to be fun. We're supposed to always be buying great things that are making us happy and our lives simpler, and we're supposed to love everyone around us. And that's not my experience. So I find life disappointing. And one way to solve that disappointment is to blame my terrible parents.
Did you go through a period of that?
Well, sure. I mean, we all do. Or I certainly did. A period where I felt alienated from them. I felt that they were part of a world that was corrupt and that I was never going to be part of. That they were hypocritical, that they were overly materialistic, that they didn't love each other in a way that I accepted, or me. I remember screaming at my father once, "You don't know anything about love. You don't know the first thing about love." And I think a lot of the things I thought about them were true, but what I didn't understand was why they felt that way and how hard it is not to feel that way and how hard they had worked and what sacrifices they had made for me.
My guest is Ben Cheever. His latest novel is called The Partisan. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with novelist Ben Cheever. His latest novel is called The Partisan. Well, this book is also about family secrets, and of course, all families have them, and I don't want to give the end of the story away either, but would you say that the secrets are always destructive? Because there's sometimes a fine line between secrets and privacy even within within a family.
Well, I'm not sure secrets are always destructive. My father had a big secret, which was that he was bisexual, and it was, I have very mixed feelings about that. I don't think he would have been the wonderful writer he was if he hadn't been the person he was, and the person he was bisexual. He was actively homophobic, or talked that way when he was around and before he came to grips with this at the end of his life, and that confused me, I think. I think it might have been better. I'm pretty sure it would have been better for me if I'd known earlier that that he had very mixed feelings about homosexuality.
And my understanding is that he told you about his bisexuality just a couple of weeks before he died.
Right.
When he told you that, did it explain some certain things? Did it turn your head around a little bit?
Yeah, it spun my head around. I was confused for quite a while afterwards. I'm still a little confused about it, but I'm not sure that he would have been a happier person had he lived a different life. I think he lived the life he wanted to live. There are people who think that he should have just expressed himself as bisexual early on and it would have been simple and he should not have had a family. There's a problem with that. If he'd not had a family, I wouldn't be around. Things are complicated, and I think he wanted to have a family, and I think he was a pretty decent father, and I think my mother and he loved each other, sometimes very intensely, and sometimes they hated each other, but I think that's what happened.
And what you're saying is confusing is the impulse to choose to be either heterosexual or homosexual, and that bisexuality somehow is even more confusing than those two ends of the spectrum?
Well, what was confusing to me was that I was taught or led to believe, not entirely by him, also by other people, that relationships with women were always going to be dangerous and mysterious, and that I was always in danger when I was in the presence of a woman I found attractive, but that relationships with men, because the sexual element was entirely missing, were safe, and I could be comfortable and noisy and messy around men, and it wouldn't be held against me. And then suddenly I discovered that I was quite mistaken about this, and that there was a sexual element in relationships with men, much more than I'd seen it. And that was very confusing to me.
Did you think when you realized or you were told by your father that he was bisexual that then you would be bisexual or that whatever sexuality you thought you had, you didn't have?
I had a little while there where I thought, well, probably it was possible that I was. I was married at this point, and I thought, well, maybe I am gay, and the reason I wasn't is because I was so frightened of his disapproval. And I waited for my gayness to express itself, and it didn't. And I noticed that when I thought of being being naughty, it was always with a woman. So I thought that probably I wasn't gay. And gay men have told me that this is not an arbitrary decision they make. This is something that's made for them.
Let me get back to something that you wrote about and about working at home. You said that you look for adult companionship, at least be able to sort of check in with someone during the day as you're home working and taking care of the kids. Do you call women? Do you call men?
Well, if it's been a real bad day, a lot of times I have my mother come over. She'll come over in the evening and help me with the kids, and we can talk a little bit. I call my sister a lot, too. During the day, if I can, I'll run with another guy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more apt to be mixed. In the old days, all my friends were men, and I had a lot of very good men friends. And that's not true now.
Are you a pretty dedicated runner?
Yeah, I'm a compulsive runner.
Okay. Which means how much do you run?
Well, it means that I recently, just in the last couple of weeks, I've been going to the gym. But it means I run 45 minutes a day, every day. I have a ski machine, so when I absolutely can't go out, I can do it inside. And if I don't do it, I get in a terrible mood. And I will get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do it if I have to. It's a drug. I think it's less harmful than some other drugs, mm-hmm. but it's a drug, and I miss it terribly if I don't have it. And I'm quite selfish about it, too. I
mean, what do you get?
Well, I've got a little voice in the back of my head that says that I'm a jerk. And if I pause, if I'm not completely involved, this little voice kicks in, and it says, "You're a jerk, Ben." And if I run hard for 40 or 45 minutes, it shuts up. It's not replaced with a voice that says, "You're great," but it just shuts up. And that's a wonderful thing.
Right? Yeah. Are you working on another book?
That's right. I'm about, I hope, a third of the way through a third novel.
Some writers love writing. Some of them love rewriting. Some of them love editing. Is there a part that you enjoy?
I love getting something right or close to right. That's very, very gratifying. I will put it off any way I can, and I make myself do it every day, because if I didn't do it every day, I probably wouldn't ever do it again.
Really?
Yeah, every time I get away from it. Well, then I sit down and I think, you know, why don't you get a job? Why are you sitting here by yourself imagining something? Why would anyone be interested in that? Whereas if I do it every day, it's a habit. I don't have to ask that.
And that's that voice that says you're a jerk?
Yeah, it says you're a jerk, and why would you think you're a novelist? I mean, what a pretentious title for a person to take on.
Novelist Ben Cheever is the son of writer John Cheever. Ben Cheever's latest book is called The Partisan. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Robert Siegel and find out what's happening on the news today. Robert, what do you have for us?
Well, Marty, we'll be hearing about a Supreme Court ruling that upholds the right to make parodies. In this case, it was the rap group Two Live Crew's parody of the old Roy Orbison song, Pretty Woman. Also today, we recall the life of Greek actress and cabinet minister Melina Mercouri, Bob Mondello on a new movie, Where the Rivers Run North, and we'll hear about two people alleged to have been part of the World Trade Center bombing case, both Iraqi nationals, who were able to flee the country right after the bombing. A researcher into the case says the U.S. should be seeking their return.
Robert, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Texas trio ZZ Top reached its peak of popularity in the early 1980s when its album Eliminator sold over 5 million copies. Its recent releases haven't done as well, which is why many in the music industry were surprised when RCA Records recently signed the band to a $30 million contract. ZZ Top's first album with RCA, Antenna, has just been released. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
Thank you. For a big-time rock act that fills arena-sized halls, ZZ Top has always been highly unlikely. They're musicians who value Howlin' Wolf and Elmore James over the Beatles and the Stones, and blues aficionados don't usually make the top 10 on the pop charts. And while drummer Frank Beard is a handsome guy, the other two, guitarist Billy Gibbons and bassist Dusty Hill, hide whatever they may really look like behind big sunglasses and beards that look like hairy dinner napkins pasted to their chins. These are not your typical teen idols. Yet somehow ZZ Top has managed to turn its eccentricities into both a good joke and a measure of integrity. Antenna features a batch of new ZZ Top songs that are both typical of everything they've done and yet livelier, lustier, down and dirtier than their last few releases. For the most part, Antenna is filled with the sort of raunchy southwestern boogie that is ZZ Top's trademark. Only one song is a bit of a departure, and it's the most interesting thing here. It's called Breakaway, and it's ZZ Top's version of a ballad, which is to say that it's boogie slowed down to a contemplative crawl, tinged with a melancholy that this group normally doesn't allow itself to admit.
It's a chemical attraction, I just can't slide by.
I'd say Antenna has a pretty good chance of making good on RCA's absurdly generous contract. ZZ Top has been out of the limelight just long enough to strike Pearl Jam fans as something new, and if the group doesn't make an adolescent-pleasing video out of the album's most pandering song, Girl in a T-Shirt, I'll be shocked by their lack of cynical savvy. 20 years after their debut album, ZZ Top are old pros who've managed to make their rigid formula seem warm and comforting.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moskowain.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
63 years ago in Marion, Indiana, a black teenager narrowly escaped being lynched. On the next Fresh Air, he tells his story. James Cameron is the founder of the Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee and the author of Time of Terror, a survivor's story. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.